Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. This week's podcast is about Russia's aims and actions in the Middle East. We'll look at how Moscow's role has shifted and what the future may bring as violence and volatility persist in the region. And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is Hanna Notte, an expert on Russian foreign policy, who is director for Eurasia at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies and a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks very much for joining me, Hanna.
Thank you for having me.
All right. It's great to have you on the show. My first question is pretty general. I want to talk about how Russia's role, approach, and aims have changed in the past few years, basically since it launched the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022 and since the attack on Israel by Hamas on October 7th of 2023. Something that was quite visible when I was in Moscow up to 2014 was the way Putin was seeking to improve ties with Israel. And Russia had also been improving ties with Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf states. Today, Russia's ties with Israel are badly frayed, while its relationship with Iran has grown tighter. Iran is giving Russia considerable support in the war against Ukraine, including by supplying drones and other weapons. Putin met with Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian in Turkmenistan earlier this month at a CIS summit, and they may meet again at the BRICS summit that starts tomorrow in Kazan in Russia. In fact, Russia and Iran are reportedly expected to sign what's called a Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Treaty there. Now, this may be, more kind of symbol than substance, but in any case, that marks an event in their relationship. Hanna, I guess I want to ask, how substantial is Russia's shift, the shift in Russia's footing or its priorities in the Middle East? What is driving it and how far might it go? And the second part of the question is, I think Putin and Russia are always looking for opportunities to kind of leverage events around the world in a way that increases Moscow's influence or scores geopolitical points. How has Russia sought to take advantage of the very turbulent developments in the Middle East? And has it been successful? And what risks does it face? Apologies, that's really more than one question, but I'd be interested in some of your thoughts on this.
Sure, happy to, Steve. So before going into what has changed with Russia's posture and its approach to the Middle East since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and then more recently since October 7th of last year, let's just take a step back and quickly look at what Russian interests and priorities were in the region prior to that. I think for Moscow, security interests were always paramount. Russia has always seen the Middle East as a potential source of spillover of instability, of extremism, of terrorism, of centrifugal tendencies. That has mattered in the context of the Chechen wars that Russia has fought, in the context of terrorist attacks on Russia. And I think Russia especially looked with alarm at the Arab Spring, which broke out in the region in 2011, fearing a spillover of instability from the region, especially to its North Caucasus region, from where Russia has seen an exodus of fighters into extremist groups in the Middle East, and then worried about returnees. So that nexus between Middle Eastern instability and sort of stability of Russia has long been important. And I think to that end, Russian diplomats have always looked at the region in terms of a need to preserve existing state order in the region, which is why they were opposed to Western responses to the Arab Spring, saw those kinds of responses in fostering democratization processes as a form of social political engineering, as an intrusion into the social political fabric of those countries, and had a certain reservation about this. Now, you can add to that, I think, that Russia also looked with alarm at the Arab Spring because it feared what it calls color revolutions in its own backyard and the spillover or domino effect of those tendencies into what it considered its own privileged sphere of influence. But that has been a long-standing, I think, concern and interest. Now, I think more recently, and with Russia's intervention in Syria, which we'll talk about a little more in detail later, so since 2015, this traditional Russian security interest in the Middle East was complemented with an additional interest, and that is, or that was for Russia to leverage its regional presence, and Russia was militarily present in Syria from that point, leverage that to sort of create a buffer zone on its southern flank or complement a sort of arc of deterrence vis-a-vis NATO and vis-a-vis the West at a time when the relationship with the West was deteriorating rapidly after the annexation of Crimea. So basically built an ability in the Middle East to push back against NATO in another theater. And so the Russians expanded and upgraded their military bases in Khmeimim and in Tartus in Syria to that end. And so that became another layer of interest. Now, quickly, there's been economic interest in the region, arms sales, building nuclear power plants, grain exports, Russian tourists going to Egypt. That has also been important, but not so significant in terms of Russia's overall GDP. But nonetheless, there have been economic opportunities for Russia. And then I think the third interest was always one about prestige and power projection. You know, Russia using the region and the various conflicts there in which Russia had a role to play, in order to promote itself as a power that can advance some sort of regional order and offer an alternative to US or Western approaches to the region to underpin Russia's claim to great power status in what Russia claims is a more multipolar world. And we saw that certainly in Syria, where the Russians over time monopolized the political process together with Turkey and Iran in what came to be known as the Astana format. But Russia also put forward certain ideas for security in the Persian Gulf. It wanted to play a role in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So you have that element. Now, I say all this, I list these Russian interests in the region, security, economic, and status, to make the point to you, Steve, that I don't think those fundamental interests have changed with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Those fundamental interests haven't changed. Russia's footprint in the region hasn't changed dramatically. Yes, after the invasion of Ukraine, there was some scaling back in Syria, some redeployment of military assets, perhaps some troop reductions, but there wasn't a sort of significant withdrawal or drawdown. Russia remains in Syria. It's also looked for ways to officialize its presence in Libya and sort of with a view of going into the Sahel. So there's a sort of an enhanced interest perhaps in Africa as a new frontier of Russian foreign and security policy. But yeah, Russia has stayed in the region. And economically, if anything, in light of Western sanctions and this harsh decoupling of Russia from Western economies, economically, the Middle East has only become more important for Russia, seeking opportunities there where it can. So before 2022 and the invasion of Ukraine, I want to talk a little bit about how Russia went about pursuing those interests, because I think that's where we've really seen a significant change over the last 2.5 years. The first thing I want to say is that prior to 2022, there was still occasional cooperation between Russia and Western countries on the Middle East, notwithstanding growing friction in the relationship. There was cooperation on Syria, whether humanitarian aid for the northwest of the country or in the political process. There was cooperation on the Iranian nuclear dossier, when it came to talks to restore the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. So there was a degree of what you could call compartmentalization in Russia's Middle East policy. It wasn't fully framed through the prism of confrontation with the West. And the other element that we saw in Russian foreign policy towards the region prior to 2022 was this careful balancing act between mutually antagonistic players in the region, between Iran and Israel and Syria, between the Syrian Kurds and Turkey, between different Gulf states when you had the blockade of Qatar, in the Libyan context. Russia really tried to do it everywhere to maintain ties with these different players. And so this is now where I want to come to the shifts since 2022 in Russian foreign policy in the Middle East. I think the first big shift that we can identify is that confrontation with the West over Ukraine has become the defining logic driving Russian policy in the region today. So whether it's in Syria, whether it's on the Iran nuclear dossier, or whether it's on Israel-Palestine, that readiness to cooperate with Western states has pretty much fallen by the wayside for Russia. And related to that, what we've seen in Russia's approach to the region is a growing tilt towards the anti-Western forces in the region. And by that, I mean Iran and Iran's partners and proxies in the so-called axis of resistance. So Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthis in Yemen, Hamas, Iraqi and Syrian militias. We've seen somewhat of a growing tilt towards those forces. That is not to say that Russia didn't already have ties with those various forces prior to 2022, but it's just this sort of slight shift. And I would argue to you that that anti-Western tilt has intensified even further with October 7th. Israel. Now, let me unpack this a little bit. I think what you've seen the Russians do since October 7th of last year is, first of all, taken a very harsh stance vis-a-vis Israel in the public domain, denigrating Israel in sort of the media campaign on the post-October 7th war in Gaza, a very pro-Palestinian posturing at the United Nations and the UN Security Council. And, you know, again, it's not like this is a total shift for Russia. There's always been a certain affinity with the Palestinian cause dating back to Soviet times, contacts in the Russian Foreign Ministry with various Palestinian factions. Russia, in fact, has tried to mediate between different Palestinian groups for years, invited them to Moscow. So there's been this sort of standing in for the Palestinian cause. I would just say that by historical comparison, it's sort of gone overboard. Russia in the past tried to be somewhat even-handed in how it would position itself on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And now it's sort of gone really into the sort of Palestinian, into the pro-Palestinian direction. Russia has also hosted delegations by Hamas and the Houthis in Moscow over the past year. And I think there's basically two reasons here, Steve, for why we're seeing Russia positioning itself in that fashion over the past year and abandoning this more even-handed approach. The first reason is Russia's growing partnership with Iran. You've mentioned it in your introduction. There's a burgeoning military defense relationship that, you know, a real qualitative shift in military cooperation compared to prior to 2022, Russian dependence on Iran for battlefield support for Ukraine. And so I think that is sort of the first explanation for why we see this Russian positioning. I think the second, and quite frankly, to me, more important reason was a desire on the Russian side and a realization that you could exploit the Palestinian issue given how it resonates, not just on what we call the Arab Street, but among broader constituencies in the global South and in fact in Western societies, to exploit the Palestinian issue and the grievances over it to sort of score points against the West, whether that's in the United Nations or in sort of the broader positioning on this conflict. So Russia, I think, realized how this would play, how that kind of positioning would allow Russia to point towards Western double standards and hypocrisy when it comes to the wars in Ukraine versus the war in Gaza. And I think that is sort of the primary reason why Russia has adopted this kind of positioning. So my bottom line to you here is that Russia's approach, to my mind, in the Middle East has now become almost entirely subservient to its confrontation with the West over Ukraine and, in fact, over global order. That's how I see that confrontation. Now, having said that, Russia has been reluctant to go all in with the anti-Western camp, with the axis of resistance in the region, because its ties to the Arab Gulf states, for instance, to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, those ties do remain important to Moscow, especially for economic reasons. And there's also no desire for a full break with Israel either, which is why you see Russian diplomats maintaining contacts very much with Israeli counterparts on the working level. So sorry for this sort of long-winded introduction to sort of where I see the lay of the land in terms of Russian shifts in the region. Now you've asked me about risks that Russia faces and Russia taking advantages of the current turbulence in the region and how that looks from a Russian viewpoint. And so I would argue to you that this recent escalation in the region has presented both advantages and risks to Moscow. So sort of let's just back up a little and have a look at what happened since the beginning of the year. We've had these waves of escalation with an uptick in Israeli operations in Syria earlier this year that, if you recall, culminated in an Israeli strike on the Iranian consulate in Damascus in April. And then there was a first Iranian retaliatory strike with ballistic missiles and drones on Israel. Then we've had a sort of further ratcheting up of tensions into the summer. The Israelis killed Hamas chief Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran. And then we had this very elaborate operation against Hezbollah in Lebanon with the sabotage of the pagers and the walkie-talkies, and that culminating in the killing of Hassan Nasrallah, the Hezbollah chief, and then a second Iranian retaliatory strike against Israel in the beginning of the month. So we've had this kind of ratcheting up of tensions, and yes, there have been certain benefits to Russia from that situation, I would argue. And the first major benefit, I think you could call the distraction dividend, because this situation in the Middle East has not just demanded considerable political attention from the United States, but also US resources going to the Middle East, especially air defense capabilities. So after October 7th of last year, the US already sent some additional Patriot batteries to the region. Ahead of the Iranian strike against Israel in April, the Americans moved additional aircraft and ballistic missile defense destroyers to the region in order to support Israel in its defense, further deployments into the summer. And then in the context of this recent Iranian attack on Israel, the U.S. also used a lot of missile defense interceptors to come to Israel's aid. And so if you accept that air defense, that those kinds of capabilities are of limited supply, which they are, because there are only so many Patriot batteries to go around and only so many SM-3 interceptors, then that is putting a certain pressure, which has been recognized in Washington, that it cannot indefinitely send air defense capabilities to both Ukraine and to Israel. And so I think that has been beneficial to Russia. There's also, I think, a more diffuse benefit at play here, which is that for as long as the war in Gaza continues and the tensions and the conflict, more broadly in the Middle East continues, Russia can sort of keep rubbing in this argument about Western impotence, hypocrisy, double standard on sort of every available occasion and in every available multilateral forum. So it can sort of step on the West's travails without actually having to do very much, which is, I think, why you see Russian diplomacy sort of largely absent from efforts to try to resolve this crisis. It's probably a matter of Russian lack of leverage, but also a matter of Russian unwillingness to get more involved. So this is on the side of the benefits, but let me just talk briefly about the risks that there are to Russia. The first risk for Russia, given these waves of escalation, is that Syria is now in the crosshairs. And since we'll talk a little bit more about Syria, I will not sort of expand on this now, but there's a risks here for Russia and Syria. There's also the risk that Iran might now come under attack by Israel. We're all waiting to see how and in what fashion the Israelis might still retaliate against Iranian territory. And so depending on what Israel might decide to hit in Iran, Iran's defense industry could come under strain. And that is something that Russia probably does not want to see, given this enhanced partnership that they have with the Iranians. Another thing that would happen if the Israelis were to attack Iran proper is that a certain Russian impotence would potentially be exposed, because I don't see that Russia could get involved in the defense of Iran in the case of this kind of escalation and Israeli retaliation. Russia would probably have to sit on the sidelines, which could incidentally harm Russian reputation. So these are some of the main risks that Russia faces. And you asked me sort of where will all this go from the Russian viewpoint. So let me just offer some concluding thoughts to my very long answer to your question. I think that the continuation of the current trend lines in the region, meaning Israel will keep taking on and hitting the axis of resistance, possibly hitting the Iranians, I think this will cause Russia to drift yet further into the orbit of Iran and the anti-Western forces in the region, and may lead to increased Russian assistance to those actors, including assistance that the Russians have so far not been willing to give. You noted the meeting between Putin and President Pezeshkian in Turkmenistan earlier this month. There's generally a lot of activity between the Russian and Iranian sides. Sergei Shoigu was in Tehran in September. Prime Minister Mishustin was just in Tehran. Yes, they are supposed to sign this strategic partnership agreement. I've heard actually they're not going to sign it in Kazan on the sidelines, but Pezeshkian is going to come to Russia for a separate occasion to sign that agreement, and we're all kind of anxious to see what will be in that agreement. So I think this trend of intensified military cooperation is likely going to continue. And the more the axis of resistance will come under pressure in the region, the more we might also see Russia giving certain assistance to Iranian partners like the Houthis, like Hezbollah. There have been some reports over the summer that Russia was considering giving such assistance, but then backed off because of Saudi pressure. And I think, you know, that might change. Russia might be more forward-leaning. And then there's also the big question, which perhaps goes beyond the scope of our conversation today, but there's a big question: what will happen to Iran's nuclear calculus as a result of all this? Will Iran come out of these developments and decide that it should possibly cross the nuclear threshold and become a nuclear-armed state? And the big question: how the Russians would position themselves in that event. And I would be inclined to say that I don't see Russia putting any obstacles or wrenches in that path where the Iranians to decide to go there. So let me just say in the final instance that even if Russia will move closer to the axis of resistance, I still think that it will try to maintain a certain balancing act in the region. It really cares about its partnerships with the Arab states. We just have, you mentioned, the BRICS summit in Kazan starting tomorrow. I think the UAE president is going to be there. The Saudis, since they still haven't made up their mind about their official status within BRICS, will not send Mohammed bin Salman, but will still send senior representation. And so keeping these states on board is very important to Russian diplomacy. And so it will continue to navigate that lay of the land.
Okay, thanks very much. Great, you know, very, very thorough answers to my many questions, and interesting to have all the great context and a look at how, I guess, Russia's kind of, you know, pursuing both kind of practical interests, including economic and security, but also very much has its status in mind, and that's driving things to some degree. So thanks very much. Now, my second question is more specific, I hope. It's about, and you mentioned a little bit about this, but it's about Russia's role in Syria and what has been happening there lately. Now, the background, as I understand it, please feel free to correct me, is that Russia lent Bashar al-Assad mainly diplomatic and some military support in his war against opponents that began in 2011. And then Russia weighed in with major military support, of course, in 2015, possibly averting Assad's downfall. He kind of had his back against the wall at that time. Russia's presence has become a bit smaller since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, but it's still there, as you said. And there's been an uptick, I think, in reported Russian air attacks in Idlib province of Syria in the past couple weeks, targeting or hitting both civilian and military areas. There were 10 civilians killed last Wednesday, according to the UK-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, and other groups have expressed concerns about what's going on there. Now, these attacks come as thousands of people displaced by Israeli strikes on Lebanon have been arriving in northwestern Syria, and after an Israeli strike near the Russian airbase at Khmeimim in Syria. Hannah, can you tell us your take on what's happening in Syria, lately, what it says, if anything, about Russia's role?
Yeah, happy to, Steve. And again, let's briefly take a step back and quickly look at how we got to where we are today in terms of Russia and Syria. You rightly said that they intervened in 2015, giving major military support to the Assad government. The Russians then launched what's called the Astana process in 2017, together with Iran and Turkey, also both military in Syria, what were at the time called these de-escalation zones in four pockets of the country that were then retaken later by the Syrian regime, with the exception of Idlib in northwest Syria, which you just mentioned, that remained outside of regime control. But essentially, since 2018, 2019, we've been in a situation in Syria where major combat operations had ended, where the regime controlled Syrian territory, with the exception of pockets in northwest Syria, Idlib and the Euphrates Shields area controlled by Turkey, and then northeast Syria, where you have the Syrian Democratic Forces and US troops, in fact. The rest controlled by the Syrian government. Russia, since 2018, 2019, heavily focused on what I like to call the three Rs: reconstruction, refugee return, and rehabilitation of the Assad government regionally and internationally. So Russian diplomacy put a lot of focus over the past years into normalizing Syria's relations with the Arab world, the League of Arab States, but also Turkey with Erdogan, something that is still in the process and hasn't sort of yielded successful results, but it's something that Russia has pushed. Whereas the political process over those years really became marginalized and essentially reduced to the question of constitutional reform. So in 2018, the Russians hosted the Sochi Congress on Syria, and what came out of that Congress was a constitutional committee that was launched in 2019 and that has met periodically in Geneva in order to work out constitutional reform, but whose work has essentially been stalled. So that's been sort of the political situation. And then you've had economic crisis in Syria due to the COVID pandemic, and then more recently, the terrible earthquake that devastated parts of Syria and Turkey. You've had remaining pockets of instability, especially in the southwest of the country. And you've also had sort of Russia's need to manage the Israelis in Syria, because Israel has taken the freedom to routinely hit Iran-backed targets, Hezbollah weapons depots over the years in Syria. And so you had a Russian-Israeli deconfliction line to manage that. That's been the situation over the last few years. Now, what has happened with Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022? Yes, some reduction in presence because of a reduced bandwidth. We've already talked about this, but the Russians very much stayed in Syria with the kind of troop presence and military presence that was required to maintain the status quo of that situation as I just described it. You've also had reduced cooperation by the Russians with Western states to manage some of those issues. So for example, a reduction in cooperation on humanitarian aid going into northwest Syria, into Idlib. So in summer 2023, the Russians blocked the extension of a mandate for cross-border aid from Turkey on the UN Security Council. They've become more reluctant to convene the Constitutional Committee in Geneva, and so that process has been stalled. Russia also stepped up what you could call coercive signaling vis-a-vis the West in Syria, engaging in harassment of US troops more blatantly, more frequently, especially last year in the northeast of the country. But having said all that, Steve, the main point I want to make to you is that Russia has been relatively risk-averse and status quo-oriented in Syria over the past 2.5 years, not wanting to rock the boat too much, precisely because the war in Ukraine is its priority and demands so much bandwidth from Russia. So Russia has not wanted to see a situation in Syria where there's significantly enhanced instability or Russia would need to sort of step up its efforts there. And there's now risks to that calculus because of the tensions in the Middle East. So in light of what we talked about earlier, this Israeli campaign against the Axis of Resistance, Israel's really stepped up its airstrikes in Syria over the last year against Hezbollah and Iranian affiliated targets. Russia, in response, stepped up its own patrols along the Golan Heights, probably to signal to both Syria and Israel to keep things calm. It's reportedly also told the Assad government to sit tight in the context of the Gaza war, to not get involved. But still, there's greater risks to Russia now. Israel hit weapons depots very close, if not on the Khmeimim airbase earlier this month. There's sort of different reports about where exactly those strikes were, but it's come very close to the Khmeimim base for sure. Russian air defenses were activated in response. This was not the first incident of that type. So the Russian-Israeli sort of deconfliction accord is now sort of, there's a big question mark hanging over it. The Israelis keep striking in Syria. Only, I think, last week they hit targets in Latakia. So this, I think, is having the Russians nervous. The Russian ambassador to Israel said just a few days ago that Israel is worried, that Russia is worried about these Israeli military actions, that it communicates this directly to the Israeli side. And so you noted these airstrikes in Idlib recently. And so my take on this is that there's perhaps an uptick in those strikes. I mean, actually, they've happened intermittently. It's not sort of totally out of the blue. It's just that the media is paying less attention, I think, to when there's airstrikes in northwest Syria because of everything else that's going on in the world. But there have been strikes over the past months. But now perhaps this increase as a Russian signaling towards the armed opposition groups in Syria not to exploit the current situation in Lebanon and the fact that hundreds of thousands of people are crossing the border, sort of another potential source of instability, not to exploit that situation to sort of try anything to rock the boat. So a signal towards the armed groups there. That is sort of my take on what could be at play here. But more fundamentally, I would argue to you that Russia is worried about a spillover of the war in Lebanon into Syria and wants to make sure to avoid that.
Okay, thanks very much. So I guess it would sort of not be obvious, but indication is that by attacking or carrying out airstrikes, and I realize, you know, you're saying that these things have been going on intermittently, but by doing violence, Russia may actually be trying to prolong or to preserve the status quo. You know.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. That's right.
All right, thanks very much for that. And I guess just l let me again, correct me if I'm wrong, but just sort of one main take from what all you've said, and this is extremely thorough. But is that Russia, for now, is essentially happy with and taking advantage of the fighting and violence and turmoil in the Middle East, but that there are ways that it threatens Russia, especially if there's further escalation, and that Russia would not be happy with that. Is that accurate?
That's right. I think currently Russia is still okay. The amount of tension and the developments have so far not threatened Russian interests or Russian position in the region. But we could sort of be stepping over a tipping point, especially if there's Israeli strikes against Israel, Israeli strikes against Iran, or a significant deterioration in Syria, where that balance could shift, and sort of the risks start outweighing some of the benefits. But for the time being, I think that the benefits still outweigh the downsides.
Okay, thanks very much. Again, we're going to wrap it up here. Thanks for joining me, Hannah.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, it's my pleasure. And once again, I've been speaking to Hannah Note, an expert on Russian foreign policy, who is director for Eurasia at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies and a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFURL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.